The Volume.
Jenkins and Jones is brought to you by FanDuel. It's never been easier to play fantasy on FanDuel. Whether you love basketball, golf, soccer, or any other fantasy sport, there's a contest for every fan. FanDuel, more ways to win. Welcome to Jenkins and Jones on the Volume Podcast Network. It is Thursday, September 16th, and we have got a lot of great stuff to talk about. We're going to do some Tenable Untenable. We are reading the first couple chapters. We're going to discuss the first couple chapters of How the Word is Passed by Clint Smith, which is our new book pick. And we're going to talk about fashion, which is something that we're actually the world's leading experts on. So I'm very excited about that. As always, Jenkins and Jones is hosted by my good friends, Dragonfly Jones, a.k.a. Tyler.
Hey, everybody. Have a good
one. Jethro Jenkins, a.k.a. John.
He threw a little season on that motherfucker at the end, didn't he? A little bit more phlegm in that motherfucker.
What's that, Bubbas?
The TAF cams are activated. We are recording. We're feeling good. Can I just say, I just, the intro thing is always so funny to me because the whole reason you're supposed to say who's on the show and then have them say something is so people know what their voices sound like. And neither one of you has ever used your real voice ever in the however many years long history of
but
this
how
podcast.
Lame does it sound like this is John? You know what I mean? Hello, this
hey,
is
hey, guys,
John.
I'm John.
Like Michael Barbaro. Like, I'm not that serious, dog. This is not a real podcast. We're just homies talking. You feel me? Like, people just happen to fuck with it.
I made a joke a couple of weeks ago that we need a whole episode from Tyler in that voice. And a couple people tweeted me and were like, I know you were joking, but I just want to be very serious that I do not need
God, no.
Absolutely
God,
not.
No. I bet they when they heard it, they were like, hell, like in their car talking to you. Hell no, Mike.
Fuck you, Mike.
Fuck you all.
All right. So let's start with Tenable Untenable. Guys, what's are Tenable or Untenable celebrity tweets about COVID-19? Is the comedy worth the ignorance? We're obviously going to talk about the Nicki Minaj one, but right before we started recording, Kyrie Irving just tweeted, my mask is off. Now take yours off. No fear.
No fear. Lions, not sheep. Right? It ain't that.
What the fuck?
People are approaching this as taking precautions to show that you're scared instead of showing that you're looking out for your fellow man. You know what I mean? Like, I get sick once or twice a year. Like, my immune system is great. You know what I mean? I'm not, quote unquote, scared of COVID. I am scared of passing it on to people. I'm scared of my mom, who's been smoking since she was 25, catching it from mm-hmm. me. You know what I mean? That's what I'm concerned about. So, you know, like I said, I just think that whole no fear shit is such macho bullshit. But that is the American exceptionalism that has been the fucking downfall of this whole COVID experience. Everyone thinks, you know, oh, we're a tough guy. We're not supposed to be scared in this country. This is the land of the free. And it's just bullshit, bro. Just look out for your fellow man and put that fucking mask on.
I mean, at first, we all were scared, right? You know what I mean? We all were like, what's when we didn't know what was happening, right? You know what I mean? As we learn more about it, mm-hmm. like, we... For the most part, like, we don't know how it's going to affect us, but we're vaccinated. You know what I'm saying? We should be fine. You know what I mean? So obviously I'm not wearing a mask for fucking me. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not a bro, if it was just me out here, I'd be out here wilding. I'd be a wild boy. You know what I'm saying? We'd be the streets would not be dead. You feel me? I'm doing it for the people around me. You feel me? So like, dog, like it's really ignorant. I think it's willfully ignorant too. I think Kyrie is weird. I don't think he's dumb. You know what I mean? So him saying
he's definitely not dumb, but he's also the kind of intelligent that you expected this.
Right. But no fear. That's willful ignorance. Just we've been talking about it enough to do it for the people around us that we think don't have a good chance fighting against COVID. You know what I'm saying? I don't know why you would even say that anymore. It's dangerous. It's dangerous. This took away the fun of the Nicki Minaj shit hearing Kyrie say this.
No. We're gonna bring it back around. But I did want to say, we mentioned previously on the show, like, this is the problem with our country, is you could write this tweet about anything and it would be effective, right? Because, like, it's just how Americans are wired. Like, oh, you're wearing a seatbelt because you're a pussy, or, you know, like, oh, you.
when you ask them about guns, I have the right to protect my family. From who, nigga? From who? You scary ass motherfucker. You need a gun to feel comfortable out here. You exist within fear constantly. You know what I'm saying? Motherfuckers out here carrying guns on them at all times. What the fuck do you call that?
But we,
you know what I'm saying? The most fearful people are saying no fear. That's what's weird to me.
And we talked about, like, the most effective way to get American men to take the vaccine would be to say that, like, they're a pussy if they don't get the vaccine, right? Like, that's just it's just how motivation happens. I don't remember if I brought it up on the show previously or not, but Beyond Meat or Impossible Meat or whoever did a campaign in Texas that was, are you afraid you'll like it? And their sales went up like 300% in Texas because it was that, like, well,
you're gonna challenge me? Yeah. You know what I'm saying? That Marty McFly, don't call me chicken.
You know? Like, everyone in this country, and I do feel like this is across racial boundaries and socioeconomic boundaries, like, every man in this country feels like they're John McClane to some extent. Like, everyone's been at an airport thinking, like, if something went crazy right now, I'd put that motherfucker in a headlock.
No, like, you wouldn't, you know, like, bitch-ass nigga. Shut up, dog. Yeah, dog. That's wild. It's wild to me.
But anyway, that was just the point I wanted to make along the lines of what Tyler was talking about. Is you could say no, like, don't be afraid of, like, literally, like, oh, you look both ways before you walk into the street. You know, like, you could do that about anything. And it's like, that's what. No, I don't think it's fear. I think there's a difference between caution and common sense and fear. You know, and so my response is, are you afraid to wear a mask? You know, like, you're too much of a pussy to wear a mask. Is the mask on your face that big of a deal? Does it feel like nuts on your chin? Like, what's your problem? You know? All right.
Like, the way we operate here is just fucking sickening, bro. Anyway.
Speaking of testes, Nicki Minaj tweeted a tweet that has 113,000 quote tweets. My cousin in Trinidad won't get the vaccine because his friend got it and became impotent. His testicles became swollen. His friend was weeks away from getting married. Now the girl called off the wedding. So, just pray on it and make sure you're comfortable with your decision. Not bullied. Gentlemen,
what STD do you think it was?
Definitely wasn't a fucking vaccine.
Mans was out here fucking, okay? That's why the wedding is off, my G. And that's why his balls are swollen. You know what I mean?
I'm not sure if this even happened, bro. Like, I put way too much thought into this swollen ball hypothetical that I should have. But I'm not sure if the swollen ball dude exists. I'm not sure if the cousin exists. The only person we know who is real in all of this is Nicki Minaj, right? Like, that's the only person we know for a concrete fact who is a real person in this scenario, right? And so here's been kind of my train of thought. I really put a lot of thought into this shit. Okay, so if Nicki Minaj's cousin exists and really said this, that doesn't necessarily mean that the cousin's friend exists, right? Because the cousin could have lied. Okay.
Now, you've been watching What If too much.
The cousin's friend actually does exist.
This man been watching a lot of What If.
Tyler Studios, What If.
Why, too?
Okay, so now if the cousin's friend exists, that means the cousin exists, and we know Nicki Minaj exists, so that means everyone exists here, right? But here's my thing. I'm not sure if the cousin exists, because my whole thing is this. I think that the cousin in question, it hasn't been implied that he's a man, but I think it's a man, because I don't think that a dude would open up to his homegirl about, you know, his nut situation, right? I don't think that men, most men would talk to their homegirl about that. You know what I'm saying? And I also don't think this. I don't think that a marriage being called off as the devastating plot line, like men don't give a fuck about that. You know what I mean? So I don't think the cousin exists. I don't think the cousin's friend exists. I think Nicki Minaj is full of shit, and she pulled out a goddamn Solan ball wedding called off hypothetical. That's where I'm at with it.
What if?
I put way too much thought into this shit, bro.
Here's my what if response. What if it is a woman cousin, and the friend is a man, and Nicki Minaj's cousin is the one who slept with the man and gave him the clap and fucked his wedding
that
up?
That big clap.
So what if Nicki Minaj is hearing, man, my name's getting dragged through the streets in Trinidad right now. My cousin's out here being a homewrecker. So she calls her cousin, and the cousin says, you know what? He got the vaccine and his balls swole up. So that's why they called the wedding off. You know, I'm not out here ruining the Minaj name.
Here's another point that I forgot to mention why I think this cousin doesn't exist. We know that odds are that this cousin is not in Nicki Minaj's tax bracket, right? 99% of the people on the planet aren't, right? So odds are that this person is nowhere near as wealthy as Nicki Minaj. Nicki Minaj does not strike me as someone who talks to the poor, family or not. You know what I mean? She does not strike me as someone who conversates with the normals. So that's another reason why I think this cousin doesn't exist, bro.
Dog, but the thing is, what if the cousin exists? And what if he just lied and it is an STD? And this lie made it all the way to Nicki Minaj's timeline. And it's like, goddamn, this was not supposed to make it this far. You know what I mean? I was just trying to hide the fact that I got the fucking clap. You know what I mean? Like, just trying to hide that. And now the whole world is talking about me. You feel me? I don't know, bro. I don't.
We got Tucker Carlson on the case.
I think
now and
all
shit.
Of it's. I think it's bullshit. I think the cousin may exist, but I don't know if the dude actually exists. I don't think that actually. But what makes you want? If you're Nicki Minaj, what do you gain by making up this elaborate ass story? Other than, you know, I mean, she doesn't. Mm-hmm. She's like you said. She's super rich. Or she's in a tax bracket that I can't even understand. You know what I'm saying? And she's online telling us, you know, bedtime Twitter stories, late night Twitter. You know what I'm saying? Why?
Well, it came up because she didn't go to the Met because they required you to be mm-hmm. vaccinated and she wasn't vaccinated.
Yeah, but
right?
Like, this is what you go. I mean,
so there's the
she's
motive.
A rapper, which is a storyteller in a
so
way.
So she's like, and this is why I feel like Tyler's right, because anytime you hear my cousin's blank, it's like, it's always, I mean, how many of our cousins bro. Had friends? How many friends of ours had cousins who had friends who work in the Pentagon over the last fucking 18 months?
What was her name?
I mean? Like,
Takesha? My cousin, Takesha. Like, she had us all in a tizzy. We was all buying bread and bonds.
And also, look at all the distancing in Nicki Minaj's story. My cousin in Trinidad's friend. Like, she is trying to separate this, you know, trying to not have it track mm-hmm. back out. This shit don't add up. She's lying, bro.
So
that's
where
I stand on.
I feel like,
and why the fuck would you lie about stolen balls and wedding?
Because she's Nicki Minaj.
I think the reason she lied is there was a headline out there that she was not at the Met because she wasn't vaccinated. I think I mentioned to you guys a friend of mine who's a young black woman who was not going to get the vaccine, covered one of these anti-vax protests, and then went and got the vaccine right afterwards. Maybe Nicki Minaj is seeing all of the Lions Not Sheep protests, sees this headline about herself, and is like, I better make sure people don't think I'm one of those, because I don't want to associate with those poors. So it's like, listen, this thing happened in my family. That's why I'm not doing it. You know
that's
what I mean?
One hell of a lie, though. God damn. Just say a regular one. You know, I mean, what happened to a good old regular lie? I mean, dude, when you're going, like you said, all that distancing, you're going to a total, all the way to Trinidad with it. We're your cousin and then the cousin's friend. So it can't be tracked to something. Like, that's a lot going in. That's a lot of thought into just saying, into why you didn't get the vaccine. There's an easier way to tell that story. You know what I'm saying?
I'm already nervous for when the show drops tomorrow, because Tyler unfortunately did a great job of explaining why he thinks what he thinks. And so I'm worried that Jackson and Adam are sitting there right now thinking, oh, we're definitely going
to
clip
they have
this
to.
Shit. And I'm worried about what's going to happen to us after.
The breakdown that Tyler had, they have to clip it. Yeah. What's wildest, I was actually thinking, I said, this is a clip. I thought in my head, this is a clip. For the, we're 10 the minutes craziest, in, and this is a clip.
But the craziest people I know on Twitter don't write Nicki Minaj out.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
what I mean? For good reason. Like,
right.
Hey, click on tweet, mute this conversation. That's how that's going to go. They post this as a clip. Fuck that.
I might. Can I mute it ahead of time? Is that a blue check privilege? Like
a lot of.
I got to email the help desk. Hey, they're going to put this tweet up about 9 o'clock Pacific, and I don't even want to know that it happened. Can you build me a little silo that I can just live in for the rest of the day, pretending that everything's
definitely
okay?
Muting the term no fear. We're muting that for sure, dog. You feel me?
Absolutely. Speaking of the Met, the three of us are, people don't know this about us actually, but all three of us understand fashion and believe
we
that it is
icons.
A high art form, and we get it. That's one thing I would say. And the Met definitely reinforced that feeling for me. So Tyler, as our chief fashion correspondent, what are your thoughts, bro, when you see people wearing this fashion that we totally get?
You know, all jokes aside, I absolutely do not fucking understand fashion. And I'm totally fine with that. You know what I'm saying? Like I'm a plain solid tee motherfucker, like gray, black, and white solid tees. Like, that's my whole shit, you know, some fucking joggers, some fucking Nikes. Like, that's my whole getup, you know, and I like my whole little, you know, style or whatever you want to call it. But bro, motherfuckers is out there in quilts. Motherfuckers are in public in quilts. Like, and then you drop the quilt. You know, A$AP Rocky took that quilt off and showed that little weak ass street magician tuxedo off, and the crowd went wild. I was like, God damn, this motherfucker look like he about to do some tricks with them big ass rings, or he about to like walk a tightrope or some shit. And the fashion world was eating up. I don't fucking get it, bro. I will never understand fashion. I'm cool with it. I never want to be. If you consider me fashionable, I feel like I have failed at something, bro. I'm a cozy boy. That's what I am. I'm cozy with it. I am not fashionable.
What tripped me out about that was like I understand like the concept of silhouettes and all this shit. Like, that shit was beefy as fuck, you know what I mean? Like, there was nothing chic or whatever the fuck you would cut those words, you know what I mean? Like, I looked, he threw that shit down and I gasped, and everybody else was like, like, yo, I was like, what the, y'all like this weak ass shit? I thought Rihanna was actually laughing at him. Because it was silly, you know what I mean? But I guess I look at fashion as like an art form, right? When the Met Gala is just like an art exhibit to me, you know, people being creative in ways they wouldn't normally, you know what I mean? So I understand that, but I'm looking at like the silhouette of that Rocky shit with them big ass fucking, you know, like shoes and like the flared ass bottom and the untucked. He just looks like you said, Tony, look, nigga, was that's a street magician outfit, dog. We've seen that, like, you know, so we've seen that a trillion times and nobody gasping like or like awed at it. You know what I mean? It meant, but A$AP Rocky throws the quilt off and everybody's. You know what I mean? Like, dog.
Everybody went crazy. Rihanna looked at him with so much adoration in that moment. I was like, I don't understand any of this. One of the most beautiful women in the planet was awestruck by that little weak ass tuxedo.
I thought she was laughing.
That goddamn Stuart little ass tuxedo.
I thought she was laughing because he threw the quilt off, and it was just a ridiculous thing to do on stairs where you have to throw it off and you pick it back up. It was weird. I don't know, but dog, that shit was. I did not get the same feeling that all the fashion people got when that shit happened at all. Like.
Well, and Russell Westbrook was out there with the American flag, dyed into his hair.
I like, you know, that. I like that. That looked tight to me. Yeah. That looked tight to me.
It all looks about the same to me, man. It's just like here is my view of fashion: is that there are some people who dress normally, and there are some people who dress weird. You know what I mean? And so, like, when Russell Westbrook did the photo shoot where he was wearing the skirt, I wasn't like, oh, men can't wear skirts or whatever. I just looked at it and I was like, oh, that's weird. You know?
To each their own, you feel me? But that's Russ.
That's our Russie.
No, 100%. It doesn't change I still, like, he's one of my favorite basketball players of all time. It doesn't change my opinion of him. It's just he's one of the people who dresses weird.
Jordan Clarkson had a kilt on, too, man. They was out there, you know what I'm saying? doing their thing.
I think there are some, like, no one appreciates all art forms, right? Like, I understand that fashion and that dancing or, like, interpretive dancing are art forms. But it's like I've just accepted over 37 years of life on this planet that I don't understand them, and they're not for me, and that's okay. I don't make fun of people who enjoy going to the ballet or whatever, but it sounds like torture to me to just watch people dance without any written words or anything. For like, I just don't understand what would appeal about that. And it's the same thing with clothes. Like, I used to watch Project Runway with Char, and it was I enjoyed watching the show. But it was because it felt like I was watching aliens. They'd be talking about this stuff, and I'd be like, absolutely, sure, like 100%. Like,
okay,
like whatever
Right. I like the concept of the kilt because it's like something you're told not to do, and they're doing it. And it looks, I mean, like, I wouldn't wear a kilt, you know, but to me, I think it looks good. I think, like, you know, the way they wear it, it looks good on them. They're also like 6'5", and I think damn near anything looks good on them, you know what I'm saying? You know, but like, I like the concept, but I just wouldn't do it. But what trips me out is, like, I was thinking, like, how, like, insane everything Frank Ocean does is. You know what I mean? Like, how, like, people are, like, so enamored with everything he does. Like, he came with, the animatronic doll, and everybody was talking about that, his jewelry and shit. And I'm just looking at this man, like, the dude makes great art, right? Like, he's but, I mean, like, he's not what you think of as a guy as famous as he is. To me, he's somewhat of a phenomenon. But like, if you take the parts, you take them apart and like look at them alone, like they're great, but you wouldn't think they add up to what they are, where he's like, you know, people lose their mind when they see Frank Ocean. You know what I'm saying? And like, this is the same dude that rides his bike in like fucking cut off sweats and a t-shirt. You know what I mean? And like, his music is great, but nobody truly understands. We don't know why we like it. Like, do you know what he's talking about in half of his songs? We feel it, but we don't know it.
I don't know.
You know what I'm saying? Like, his jewelry's going crazy and it's tight, but like, but people are losing their mind over it. He's interesting me. When I was watching that and like seeing him walk around with the animatronic doll and like his hair dye, you know, crazy, but you know what I'm saying? Like, and see people talk about him, it's like, damn, how did Frank Ocean become Frank Ocean? But I don't know. That has nothing to do with fashion.
Frank Ocean born in
Long Beach. Oh, really? Crazy.
Yep. So he had the boost. He got the plus right out the 10 womb. Multiplier right off. Yeah.
He had 10 rings, 10 sonic rings out the womb.
I think he lived here for about a week before they moved.
Yeah, born in Long Beach, grew up in New Orleans, bro. Like, you knew he was gonna be
there.
A
we
cool
go. That makes sense.
But yeah, yo, kilts are probably comfortable as fuck. Like, you ever hop out the shower and you put your towel around your waist and you're like, hold up, this is comfortable as fuck. I'm about to just spend all day like
I
this.
I do that.
Are you ever had one of those?
I did that.
Kilts are probably comfy
I do that, like,
as hell.
3 times a week, where I hop out the shower and just like at night and just don't put. I keep the towel on for the rest of the night. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I mean, skirts or kilts or, you know, whatever you want to call them, like, that probably makes more sense than pants, you know, like, in some regards, unless you're walking over long, I don't know. But, like, it certainly seems like it would be cooler.
Yeah, breezy. Like, I think it would be really, that would be comforting. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, I'm just, you know, I think, bro, like, I got shoulders like I'm 6'3". But I'm not. I'm 5'11". So I think I got to play it real cool with the shit I choose. I stick to t-shirts and like, I might switch it from my pants to some cargo pants ever so often. But I keep it real simple, bro. You know what I mean? When you're like.
The one that I can't wrap my brain around, and this is a stupid thing to admit, is for about 10 years, the younger generation, the teens, have been on the short shorts wave. And it's still, every time I see it as a product of the 90s in Long Beach, California, it's like, your shorts should be 7 times larger than that.
I got the short shorts. I like the quads out. I'm fucking with it. The thing with me is,
I have quads too. Yeah, I should have mine out, but I just like, to me, if my shorts don't touch my knees, I feel like I did something
wrong. Man.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm about to get
slapped
in the back of my neck.
You
got to
join us in the future, dog. This man in 2006 used to wear your shorts under your jeans, nigga, ready to hoop at all times. You feel me? No, man, but like, yeah, I don't with shorts. I'm cool with that shit. But like, the other things, I think, like, when my fashion, when I stopped fucking with like fashion, was when skinny jeans came. Because I remember the exact moment being at Urban Outfitters, trying on skinny jeans, pulling my jeans, trying them on, and like, this ain't it. Pulling them down, and it pulled my drawers with them, and my dick was just out in the fucking... And I'm like, nigga, yep, this is where it is, bro. I think I was 24. I'm like, this is where it is, dog. Like, we just flannels and we regular nigga shit from here on out, dog. You ain't built for where this is headed. You know what I mean? Literally, physically, I can't go with these people. You know what I'm saying? Like,
I think anyone who knows you, who listens to the pod, has a very clear image of you at Urban Outfitters trying on skinny jeans. Like, that's such a vivid image.
It was,
bro,
right when they dropped to. I'm like, let's see what time it is. You know what I mean? I don't know, but I'm open. I'm an open person. I'm open minded. You know what I mean? I tried, and the universe was like, no, nigga. Fuck is you? Take your ass out of Urban and go. Take your...
Trying to pack your fucking quads into the fucking skinny jeans.
Take your ass back to Dillard's, nigga. This ain't made for you. Get you some polo, bitch.
Using a shoehorn to try and cram your quads into the fucking
like
jean
my only leg. Pants are like Carhartt pants for the most part. You know what I mean? Like, I went right to where I was supposed to go and stayed there, my nigga. Like, Carhartt Work in Progress has held me down since. So that was a rough time, though. Imagine that, dog. Dick out in the fucking, you know, it's in the change room of Urban. You can't ignore that moment. It's telling you everything you need to know. I'm butt naked in this fucking...
So that's the universe fucking, speaking to your ass.
I'm booty hole out in the fucking changing room. Nigga, get the fuck out of here immediately. God damn. Anyway.
It's like the George Bush era bumper stickers. If you're not mad, you're not paying attention. Right. You know, it's like the universe was speaking. So if you didn't hear anything, it's because you weren't listening. You know?
I saw it loud and clear, though, bro. I saw it for sure. Anyway.
The NFL is back. FanDuel Sportsbook wants you to get the most out of every play. That's why they're giving everyone a $10 risk-free bet every week. All you have to do is bet a same-game parlay bet with three legs or more, and if your bet doesn't win, FanDuel will pay you back up to $10. We've got a big Sunday night football game coming up. The Chiefs are visiting the Ravens. I think the Chiefs are a lock to cover. I would take the Chiefs. I would take the under total points in the fourth quarter. I think everyone will be playing great defense by the end of that game. But I would take the over on rushing yards from Lamar Jackson because I think he's going to be scrambling a lot. Make sure you look for that same game parlay icon to know what markets are eligible for same game parlays. But those are not the only reason I love betting on all the NFL action with FanDuel Sportsbook. They've got fast payouts. It's easy to use. It's safe and secure. It's America's number one sportsbook. There's no feeling like nailing a same-game parlay bet, so lock in your bet today on FanDuel Sportsbook and get up to $10 back if your bet doesn't win. New to FanDuel Sportsbook, they're also offering a risk-free $1,000 bet if you prefer that. Just sign up with promo code JANJ. That's J&J. And if your first bet loses, you get up to $1,000 back in site credit. That's promo code J&J. Must be 21 and over and present in Arizona, Colorado, Indiana, Michigan, New Jersey, Tennessee, Virginia, or West Virginia. Refund issued as non-withdrawable site credit that expires in 7 days. Max refund $10. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Same game parlay available for multiple sports in all states on mobile/web. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit fanduel.com/RG in Colorado, New Jersey, or Virginia. 1-800-9-WITH-IT in Indiana. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. Call the TN Red Line at 1-800-889-9789 in Tennessee, www.1800gambler.net in West Virginia, or call 1-800-NEXT-STEP or text NEXTSTEP to 53342 in Arizona. All right. We are going to start talking about our second book of Book Club 2.0, The Fuck Football. We out here reading Tyler's favorite type of writer book club. The book we're reading, a second book, is How the Word is Passed by Clint Smith. I think we had told people last episode to read through the end of Angola Prison, but we are going to stop a chapter short of that because John had some birthing classes that are more important to him than reading this book at the moment for some reason. So we are talking about the first two chapters, which are about the, which actually is a better stopping point because the first two chapters are sort of mirrors of each other. The Monticello plantation and the Whitney plantation. I'll just introduce the book. I think we had Tyler do that. But the reason I picked this book is I heard Clint Smith, who's similar to Hanif, who we had on last week. Clint is a poet who needs to make a living, so also writes other things. he writes for The Atlantic. Brilliant writer. I knew him as a soccer writer initially, I think. and then he's been brilliant writing everything that he's ever written. And then this book was, the subtitle is A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. And I think it's sort of the missing book. John and I have talked about this with Warmth of Other Suns as well by Isabel Wilkerson about the great migration of black people out of the South. But this book to me is like the missing history mm-hmm. book. Like, and I had liberal, progressive history teachers who I never really got the, I never really got whatever the standard line is that I guess a lot of people sort of get about America. Like, we learned the truth about Christopher Columbus in eighth grade in my mm-hmm. history class, you know? So, but there's still a huge problem with the way America talks about and thinks about slavery as a piece of its history and as really something that's woven throughout its whole history. And I heard Clint on another podcast, and he was sort of pitching the book. And as soon as he said that, as soon as they mentioned that he was a poet, I was like, okay, I need to definitely make sure I check this out because it's a heavy book. It's not necessarily something I would have picked up. But I think it's important that we confront this huge part of the country's history as a country. A lot of people have written about the way that Germany confronts its history with the Nazis and World War II so much more bluntly than we do our history with slavery. And that, you know, people think that that's part of why they were able to maybe more successful at moving past mm-hmm. that, right? Like we were just talking last episode, they just took down a Robert E. Lee statue in Tyler's hometown. Like this dude tried to overthrow the country. And then, there was an mm-hmm. elementary school named after him in Long Beach, you know, for the longest time. Like, so like that's the history of the country that I think Clint is trying to fill in here. And the way the book is told is by visiting different locations that are trying to reckon with that history. Not just set in the South. There's a chapter later in the book where he visits New York that was actually particularly impactful for me. But that's the pitch on the book. I think it's beautifully written. I think he absolutely is a poet, and that kind of makes it easier to take some of the hard stuff that's in the book. And the first two chapters are talking about the Monticello plantation, which is where Thomas Jefferson lived, which is basically a monument to Thomas Jefferson with some additional tours and lessons about slavery that the people who work there have been sort of changing that and putting that more into the history they acknowledge. And then the second chapter is about the Whitney plantation, which I think is the only plantation in the country that's like, this is not mm-hmm. a nice house mm-hmm. For people to get married at. This is here as a museum about slavery and what people went through. So I thought, you know, it's a nice place to start the book and talking about the book because they're so sort of opposed to each other. Before we start really the conversation, I do want to mention that the Whitney plantation was I think really severely damaged by Hurricane Ida a couple weeks ago. And there are, I'll tweet it out tomorrow, but you can go and donate to try and help them rebuild. Cause it is a nonprofit that exists to teach this really important part of our history. And it is unfortunately kind of unique in the country in doing so. So just keep that in mind as we talk about it, that's how tenuous it is in this country to actually teach people this shit, that if a hurricane hits one part of Louisiana, one of the only real museums that's doing that work can be kind of knocked down. So that's my intro and my preamble about why I kind of picked it. But what was your guys' reaction to, you know, the first 100 pages or so of the book?
You know, you mentioned that this book is taking an approach to kind of you know, shed some light and kind of, you know, debunk some conceptions of slavery. And I think that's absolutely right. I think that in this book, Clint is, I feel like so often we look at slavery from, you know, a macro point of view, like the wide eye lens, like this happened over hundreds of years to millions of people, rather than, you know, this happened to families, this happened to grandmothers, this happened to mothers, this happened to little sisters, you know what I mean? And there's a paragraph in here that kind of, you know, hammered that point home, where Clint was talking about when he went to the Monticello tour and he met these two middle-aged white women from like Florida who were touring there. Their names were Donna and Grace. And, you know, they said that, you know, they had no idea that Thomas Jefferson was a slaveholder and, you know, was overseeing all these atrocities that happened on the plantation. And I'm going to read this paragraph right quick. So Donna and Grace and so many people, specifically white people, often have understood slavery and those held in its grips only in abstract terms. They do not see the faces. They cannot picture the hands. They do not hear the fear or the laughter. They do not consider that these were children like their own, or that these were people who had birthdays and weddings and funerals, who loved and celebrated one another just as they loved and celebrated their loved ones. So I think that was kind of, you know, the paragraph that kind of summarized, you know, what Clint's objective is with this book. And, you know, so for the first chapter with Monticello, it feels like that was, I feel like Clint's objective in that was to debunk the mythologizing, the flat out lying of the notion of benevolent slave owners. You know what I mean? Because that's kind of what people have used to justify Thomas Jefferson. Like, you know, if you look at, you know, the way that we're taught about history, it's always kind of been connotated like, you know, George Washington, he was the military brawn, and Thomas Jefferson, he was the great mind that built this nation, right? And, you know, I think they said he owned close to like 1,300 slaves in his lifetime on Monticello, I think. And the whole notion of a benevolent slave owner is a fucking oxymoron, because you cannot be benevolent while owning people and committing these atrocities and physically punishing, you know, people for stepping out of bounds and separating families for your own profit and such. There's no such thing as a benevolent slave owner. So, you know, I thought that was a good chapter right there in regards to debunking that.
Yvonne talks about that. She in the Whitney Plantation, she talks about how people will ask her, were there any good slave owners? And her response is, regardless of how these individuals fed people they owned, regardless of how they clothed them, regardless of if they never laid a hand on them, they were still sanctioning the system. You can't say, hey, this person kidnapped your child, but they fed them well. They were a good person. How absurd does that sound? You know what I mean? Like, and you could see how frustrated she was. She talked about how frustrated she was when that question was even asked, like how she had to, you know what I mean? Like, were there any good slave owners to make you feel good? No, the system as a whole was trash and you participated and you were fucking trash too. You know what I'm saying? But I thought it was, there was a, let me see, it's the last paragraph of the Monticello joint. And this made me want, like, I like this book because, like you said, Mike, you said it was heavy, but he's a poet. He only lets his poet, like the poet in him, kind of seep through in certain moments. Like when he's describing a moment, you can feel like the, and then it hits you right in the face with a fucking, you know what I'm saying? But David, the tour guide from Monticello, who was like, you know, kind of, you know, it seemed like it would be conflicting that he was in the Navy for so long. He was a military man, you know what I'm saying, before coming. But he was like hella honest and telling folks exactly what fucking time it was. You know what I mean? Clint asked him a question when he visited before he left after the second time he visited. And this made me want to this is why I think it's important for people to go and visit these places. And I was thinking, like, I'm gonna take my daughter to these motherfuckers. I'm taking them to the Monticello plantation, and I'm taking her to fucking Whitney. She must, you know, I want her to understand it in a different way from just reading books, because, you know, we were taught about slavery, but we weren't taught the truth. You know what I'm saying? They always manipulated, saying things like calling, you know, George Washington, you know what I'm saying? Saying he can never tell a lie, but he had in his mouth, he actually had teeth of slaves. You know what I'm saying? He had torn out of their mouth. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's absolute bullshit. You're manipulating the truth in ways that, and it's just ridiculous. But anyway, you said one of the last, this is the last paragraph of the Monticello plantation chapter. One of the last things David said before I left my second tour in Monticello spoke to this duality, talking about, you know, Thomas Jefferson's duality. You're here. You're here. Sally's brother James Hemings got beat here. Not in a book, right? Right here is where that happened. When 100 enslaved people in Monticello were auctioned after Jefferson's death, it was right there in the West Lawn behind us. David continued, it happened right there. And Jefferson's ideas about the Declaration of Independence, even though he wrote that document in Philadelphia, his whole idea of where he was going was formulated right here on this mountaintop. You know what I'm saying? So, like, you know, like, I thought that was a great way of showing, like, yeah, like, he did, you know, write the Declaration of Independence, but he wrote it, you know, it was surrounded by slaves, you know, understanding that they wouldn't participate in that in the way that, you know what I'm saying, the way that he was writing it, you know what I'm saying? But I thought, like I said, I loved how it was written because we do get to see the poetry. It kind of like, you know, it's like a palate cleanser because it can be hard to read parts of this. In Hanif's book, you know, it's poetry is everywhere. You know what I mean? Here it's like, yo, here's a little poetry. Now deal with this fucking truth. You know what I'm saying? Like, and I think that's a really smart way to deliver messages that are this difficult to watch, you know, to read. Like with the Whitney, way he described, like the images of the heads on stakes, from the, you know, signifying the people that, you know, had the uprising in Louisiana at the Whitney plantation. It was, the description was beautiful, which allowed us to, you know, read it without, you know what I'm saying, read a very troubling, you know, truth, without, like, you know, I need to put this book down for a second. You know what I mean? Like, it, you know, yeah, allows you to keep going. So I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. First of all, I just want to say, we mentioned when we first started talking about the about Hanif's book that, like, I would just wish it was more of a normal thing to, like, read books with your friends and talk about them, because I literally had marked the exact same passage that Tyler read to read. And, like, you never get that from liking the same scene in a movie. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, that tripped me out. I think something that the simplest move he made in this book, but that I think changes the perspective for the whole thing, is that he never uses the word slaves. He uses the phrase enslaved people. And I think that is the exact shift that John was talking about. We talk about slavery and we talk about, oh, there were quote unquote slaves when we talk about the history of the country. But that's not, it's exactly what Tyler said. And it was why I had marked the same passage, is the way that you reckon with the history is to understand the numbers, is to understand that every time you hear one person who is enslaved, that's you, or that's your kid, or it's your mom, or it's your dad. And they're exactly the same amount of a person as you. And I think that intentionally, obviously, through hundreds of years of effort, we have, as a country, not thought of people who are enslaved that way. You know, like Tyler mentioned, the myths around the benevolent plantation owners, or, you know, there's this idea of, like, oh, they were being educated and fed, or, you know, and it's like that. But that's really something people were like, and he talks about that in the Whitney plantation. People really put effort into getting that thought into textbooks. And so this, to me, is the antidote for that, of consider every single person is yourself, and think about how you think about Thomas Jefferson now. Think about how, and, you know, as the book moves on, this is mentioned briefly in the Whitney plantation chapter when I think it was Yvonne was talking about this, but she talked about the fact that, like, the whole world was caught up in this system. And he's going to get a lot more into that later in the book. But she said to him, poor people can now afford sweetener, which used to be reserved for the elite. So these individuals are going to work, and now they can start purchasing sweetener for their afternoon tea. And then they start to demand it. And that is in direct correlation to the people who are enslaved on these plantations. So it helps people understand that it's not cut and dry. It's not just like these overseers were sadistic people. The plantations were morally bankrupt and corrupt. Yes, they were. But also in Europe, once the appetite for sugar and chocolate and coffee and cheap textiles and all these things started flooding the market, and people can finally buy into this larger system of capitalism and consumption, who is at the other end of it? And that to me is what I don't know, like that to be, thinking about people who are enslaved as individual human beings was one sort of slap in the face, I think, that everyone needs. And the other one is that of thinking about like people who just were people who were poets who, you know, lived in England and just, oh, I can afford tea now. We're buying sugar from the from that was, you know, produced from people working on these plantations. And, you know, I mean, I dislike any analogy that includes like slavery or the Holocaust because there's singular atrocities in human history. But similarly, every store you walk into is selling something that was made by some sort of people under somebody's boot, whether that's your phone or clothes or jewelry, whatever. Like, that's still the way the world is. We've just offloaded that to other countries at this point, you know, like, and it's sort of hopeless in a way because there's no way to really, without investing your whole life in research and like, there's no way to feel like you can change that. But I think it's, to me, in my family, we're big believers in the like nothing can be fixed until it's faced, right? And I think that the number one thing to me is we should at least know that, right? Like, we should all understand that that is how this country got built, that that's how Wall Street got built, that that's how liberal institutions like museums and all these other places that people who are, you know, anti-racist and all this other stuff, like things that we all enjoy came from this history. And I think that this way of sort of going from place to place is like a perfect way to illustrate that, I guess. I thought the Donna and Grace part in the Monticello chapter was like very telling. The fact that I think, what was the phrase she said? This really took the shine off the guy.
Like, there was shine. I mean, when you look at most presidents, like the richest presidents were all rich off of slavery. You know, I mean, there was like a list of the richest, the presidents from richest to, you know, not rich, which is still rich, but not, you know what I'm saying, just less rich. And the richest ones were all rich due to slavery, you know what I'm saying, due to their ability to enslave people. But like, what tripped me out about this book too is I've never really heard people like the depiction of women and their experience in slavery. You know what I mean? To this level where talking about like how, like an actual story of how this slave's mom had 15 kids, all from 15 dads, because she was 15 different dudes because she was sold 15 times. You know what I'm saying? How, right, like the women's, there were plantations where they were all women and only white men were allowed to come. And they were basically breeding mixed babies that were going to be enslaved. You know, there was a, which is my fucking God. You know what I mean? Like, how does
the horror, of, you know what I'm saying?
And then also like the story
around,
of the woman who was like on the trading block and praying to a God that she may not even truly believed in, but only believed in because that's all she had to at that point to yell to ask for forgiveness for. So that she's not separated from her child. You know what I mean? Like, how can you think that a benevolent slave owner exists when you're hearing these stories? You know what I'm saying? And how, you know, you're separating. It said like, I think 50 or 70% of children who were born into slavery were separated from their families. Like, yeah, my nigga, like, you know what I'm saying? Like this, he's going into the depths of how like dastardly the system was. But like, it talks, there's this one, some page 64, the second paragraph. He talks about like white supremacy and like, you know, how it is. And he's like, he said, I thought of my primary and secondary education. I remembered feeling crippling guilt as I silently wondered why every enslaved person couldn't simply escape like Douglas, Tubman, and Jacobs had. I found myself angered by the stories of those who did not escape. Had they not tried hard enough? Did they care enough to do something? Did they choose to remain enslaved? I now realize is part of the insidiousness of white supremacy. It illuminates the exceptional in order to implicitly blame those who cannot, in the most brutal circumstances, attain superhuman heights. It does this instead of blaming the system, the people who built it, the people who maintained it. You know what I'm saying? And I thought that was like, you know, breaking down, like, you know, like how like it affects him today in grade school as a young dude, questioning the slaves who didn't manage to escape, not understanding that, you know, like, some, the impossibility of what Frederick Douglass and, you know what I'm saying, Harriet Tubman did. You know what I mean? But yeah, it's...
That was the other part that I marked to read.
Reading with friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that's exactly, like... Tell me if you think this is bullshit, because I want to ask you also what you guys thought about that, as black dudes, what you thought about that, passage, about, you know, when you were learning about this stuff in school. But as a white kid who grew up with liberal parents, right, and I, you know, we talk a lot about white liberals and shit. I think this is how I viewed history. Things used to be bad, and now they're better. And there was a relativity of that viewpoint that was like, not quite a forgiveness, but a like, well, people back then didn't know better, right? Like, was, you know, segregation was bad, but now it's better. Slavery was bad, but then the slaves were, you know, enslaved people were freed. And so now that's not the thing anymore. Confronting this and seeing, like... And again, he gets more into this throughout the book, but seeing that, like, there were a lot of people at the time who knew exactly how wrong this was. This was not an era of living in this time where it was like, well, at the time they believed this was acceptable. And the other thing I would say is to read the actual accounts. I don't care if it was fucking 2000 BC, if it was 1850, if it's whatever. No human being who could watch a mother screaming for her baby and carry through with separating them can be considered a human being. Yeah. Like, there's no, well, back then, but then we fought a war. Like, that's the disruption to history for me, is even if I grew up in a liberal city with liberal parents, but there's still a fairy tale of this, the way we look at history and the way we think of the sort of narrative arc, not just of our country, I think, but of the world. And that those scenes for me, like Clint talked about being at the Whitney plantation and seeing specifically the memorial set up for the
at the infants. Church at the church. Yeah.
Yeah. And in reading it, I felt as a father who, I mean, you know, anyone who listens to the show knows, like, my happiest moments, the most pure moments of my life involve my kids, especially when they were babies and toddlers. I felt this panic in my chest reading that section of thinking about myself and my kids and what that would be like. And then he then described, as someone who had a 2-month-old child himself, feeling that same panic. And he described what I would have said was an indescribable feeling perfectly. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was like I had to put it down for a little bit after that. Because you do, I mean, you just have to think about that. Like, I think a lot of white liberals out there, and I would say that for quite a while I was one of them, who were like, Robert E. Lee's name shouldn't be on fucking anything, but... You know, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, for all, quote unquote, for all their flaws, whatever, you know, they brought us forward in history, you know, whatever. There were positive things about them. You read this stuff, and I don't think you can confront the reality of what owning people was and not have that color every other thing you think about a person. You know, the Monticello chapter was interesting, seeing how they're trying to sort of still separate those things a little bit. But yeah, I don't know. I don't think you can read this book, you can read this stuff and not have it change the way you sort of think about everything. I don't know.
You talked about it dehumanize, you can't, not the people that are participating in this not being humans. And like, he talks about this a little bit, but you know, like it, like how slavery dehumanizes slaves. I think the people that were less than human were the slave owners, the people that participated in the system. I saw the humanity in the slaves. I connected with that humanity. Right. I couldn't connect with the humanity of the slave owners. I don't see how they could participate in this in any way. You know what I'm saying?
They go to dinner. Yeah, like no, bro. Like, you know what I mean?
The dude that separated the child goes in with their child. You know, like, or their family afterwards. You know what I'm saying? Like, I remember seeing a dude. I remember before even having a kid or whatever, like, even, you know, all of this shit, this guy whose child had died due to a school shooting. And I don't know if y'all remember when the dude was like, that was my boy. And
right,
like, I get emotional thinking about that now, like how the connection he had with his child, and now they don't have the child anymore. But to think about like a mom and to see like you know, my lady, like how connected she is from jump to the child, like feeling that child moving your stomach, you know what I mean? Feeding that child from your actual body, you know, breastfeeding that child. And then for somebody to just, you know, sell the child away as if that child is not, you know, a piece of you, is like, how can that be a human? And I think the thing with, like, you said, like, you just thought they were, that was things were, you know, how you looked at it as a kid. For me, I think black people in particular can't ignore the truth of America. I never was allowed the ability to. I never was allowed to. They talk, and Hanif talks about why parents beat their children back in the day to mimic what was going, and how that has been passed down to now, where our parents beat us because, like, they knew that we didn't have the same amount of opportunities. You know what I'm saying? We didn't have opportunities to make mistakes, as like my friends did when I was in the suburbs. You feel what I'm saying? And so, like, yeah, like, I was not allowed to ignore the truth of America. So, like, when I'm reading this slave shit, I'm like, you know, I saw the parallels, you know what I'm saying? As far as, like, in some ways, I remember being as a kid, my I think after seeing Roots, it fucked me up in fourth grade. You know what I mean? Like, after that, it was kind of different for me. I remember going to school the next day. My sister was talking about this when we went to visit. We went on that little trip to my middle school or whatever, but where I was like asked, like, why are we saying the Pledge of Allegiance every day? You know what I'm saying? Like, I felt like, right, I was being brainwashed to believe something that wasn't reality. You know what I'm saying? And I was like in fourth, fifth grade. You feel me? So I think we kind of taught that at a young age. So we're like, yeah, it's better, but it's shit still ain't sweet. You know what I'm saying? And even as kids, we're not allowed to, you know what I'm saying, to feel that way. So yeah, when I was in school looking around, like, yeah, I didn't. It wasn't just like this was now. I'm wondering, like, why aren't we going deeper into the realities? Because, like, I was taught some of that shit at home as well. You know, it felt like, you know, it felt like bullshit to me to a degree. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, there's no way that I can ever view any slave owner as a great man. You know. We can, I'm not saying that, you know, these accomplishments of these men should be stricken from history, because you can't just erase history like that. Sure, you know, Washington was a great military strategist, great military mind. You know, he was still a terrible man because he owned slaves. You know, Thomas Jefferson was a great mind who helped construct the framework of our democracy. Still a terrible man because he owned slaves. So that's what it comes down to me. And I'm going to say something that really blew me away, and it blew Clint Smith away too, because he didn't know this either. I had no idea that the Louisiana Purchase, that, you know, where we bought Louisiana and pretty much all of the damn Midwest, I had no idea that France sold that to us to finance their efforts in the Haitian Revolution. To, you know, basically France sold us half our country so they could fight for slavery in Haiti. And I never knew that until this book. Clint grew up in Louisiana and didn't know that until visiting the Whitney plantation. So, you know, that was just a moment that just kind of took me aback. Like, wow, there's so much that we still have to learn out here that they are not teaching us.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. And him talking about, you know, the passage that John read about him feeling like, oh, you know, if other people had tried harder, or if they'd cared more, they could have been Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, or something. I'm amazed at his ability to describe the sort of reckoning that he's going through. And he talks about, like, he went to elementary school, like, not like an hour away from that plantation. I mean, like, you know, like this, I think when you grow up in the West, American history is kind of, it's different. It feels different when you're learning about it, because you're like, my state wasn't founded until half this shit had, you know, was over or whatever. You don't feel that that same connection necessarily. And I just couldn't imagine that standing somewhere. Like, for me, that would be like standing in the valley in L.A.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Realizing that everything that I was thinking and being taught in elementary school was a lie. Like, that's, I don't know. But he wrote about that beautifully as well. All right. Do we have any other thoughts about the first little bit of it?
I think I think we talked about that. I think we dove pretty deep into that motherfucker. You feel what I'm saying?
Yeah. Do we want to read the rest of it for next week, or do we want to break it up into two more chunks?
I mean, I got three birthing classes a night for
let's break it up into two more chunks. Knock it out on the weekend,
I could probably knock it out on the weekend for sure. I got time on the weekend for sure. So.
What do you think? I mean, I'm fine to do either way. Like, basketball not starting for a little bit.
Yeah, let's split it up. Let's split it up into two more pieces. Yeah, let's do it that way, dude. That makes more sense.
Okay. Let's read the next three chapters then. That would be the Angola Prison, Blandford Cemetery, and Galveston Island next. And then the following week, we'll read the last 100 pages. So basically, it'll be like 80 pages, yeah. 100 pages, 100 pages. Yeah. So but we'll read the next three chapters.
One thing I wanted to say, like when Tyler was talking about how these people were, they were great minds, but still not good humans. It's like, I think the fact that they were great minds, that they were so brilliant, is more damning. You know what I mean? You fully understood it. You weren't ignorant to what you were doing. You know what I'm saying? Jefferson wasn't ignorant to what he was doing. He was trying to reconcile in a way, but you can't reconcile with that. You know what I'm saying? There's no reconciling with what you were doing. So, yeah, he was not a good man, regardless of how brilliant he was. And I think his brilliance is actually damning.
I think maybe the most damning thing to me about Jefferson in that chapter was Clint describing how many times Jefferson wrote that he thought about himself as one of the nice ones.
He was telling himself that, though. You know what I mean?
He was telling – no, but that's – but the fact that you could do that – while these things are happening to people at your house.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and I don't think you can drive that point home enough. Like the insanity, and, you know, John is in the same emotional place that I was when my wife was about to have our first child. The idea that you could have a kid and then enslave that child is, I don't have a way to ever move past that in the way that I would think about a person. And so the idea that you could participate in something like that while thinking, oh, well, there are people out there who are worse than me is, I don't know. That's not reconcilable.
That's him grasping at his humanity.
Me, you know,
that's what he's doing. He's grasping at his humanity, trying to find it, trying to hold on to it, participating in something that is inhumane. You know what I'm saying? It talks about how his whole livelihood was off of that. You know what I'm saying? He had a particular way. He
got into financial trouble. He got into financial trouble.
Split up a few.
And Mr. I want to keep families together. Split up a few families that quick,
you know, so he could, you know, so they could have three turkeys at Thanksgiving instead of one. You know what I'm saying? Like,
is that not the people who live near me? Is that not white liberals today who say, I'm anti-racist, I'm against all this shit, but I'm gonna make sure my kids go to the whitest school.
Still
the
clutch their purse when
in.
You pull up next to them. You know what I'm saying? Like,
You know, and it drives home to me that no one alive today built the world that they live in. But that can't be the end of your thought about anything. You know, like. Because it's the same thing for Thomas Jefferson, for anyone who was enslaving people in that time. Like, history, like, I used to think that history was relative to an extent, I guess is what I was trying to say earlier. That, like, there was people in the middle, good people and bad people at every point throughout history. But this has been and I'm sure that 50 years from now, there'll be shit that we look at in our lives 100 years from now that's unthinkable to us. That at the moment we feel is regular. I'm sure there's things we aren't confronting that we should be. In California, I'm sure the way we look at people who are living on the street, we'll look back, I hope one day, and think that we were fucking animals for allowing the world to be the way that it is right now, you know?
If there's a heaven and your ancestors participated in slavery, you cannot speak to them because they're in hell. Point blank. Fuck them two times. And that's a fact. You feel me?
And on that note, that's all I got for Jenkins and Jones. Thank you so much to everyone who's reading along with us in the book club. And like I said, we'll read the next three chapters for next Thursday's show. And
bye.
Bye.
Bye.